Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has launched a national program that provides daily medications to prevent HIV at no cost to people without prescription drug insurance coverage. The program could benefit the more than 1 million people in the U.S. who are at risk for HIV, and it is hoped to reduce the number of new HIV infections by 90% in 10 years. Douglas O'Brien is the regional director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He joins us. Welcome, Douglas O'Brien.
Good morning, Ann.
So this isn't a vaccine. It's a prophylactic type medication. What does it do and how is it administered?
Well, you know, one of the things that's really important to know is that, you know, 30 years ago, really when HIV and AIDS came on the scene, it had medical science stumped. And you know, we were collectively grasping for some way to deal with this new illness that was really a death sentence then. You know, 3 decades later, we're in a great position with new technology and new science to be able to essentially eliminate HIV in this country. And that's really the genesis of the administration's undertaking here. What PrEP is PrEP is developed sort of out of the various treatment protocols that have been utilized over the years and has narrowed down to basically a series of drugs combined together that provide protection from infection for people who are at risk. And really, it's part of a two-stage process. We want to make sure that people who are infected, that the virus is suppressed. So essentially, if it's suppressed and undetectable, it can't be transmitted. And then to protect people at risk so that they don't contract HIV. And by doing those two things, we really have a tremendous opportunity to essentially eliminate HIV in America.
Who's at risk?
A lot of traditionally underserved populations, and that's why this has really changed from a medical question to a public health question, because now we're dealing with traditionally underserved populations, homeless, chronic drug users. Obviously, men who have sex with men is still the biggest population where transmission is most likely. But now we're working really to raise awareness and to try to identify people at risk who come from less connected populations. And really, we need to be more interventional in reaching those individuals through our public health infrastructure, through our partners at the community level.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about the new U.S. Department of Health and Human Services program that provides medications to prevent HIV at no cost to people without prescription drug insurance coverage. It's a two-stage program, really. It's to suppress some drugs are used to suppress the virus in people who already have it. And as my guest, Douglas O'Brien, Regional Director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, said, the other stage is to protect people who are at risk. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said some of the people who are at risk include people are from less connected populations. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, obviously, a lot of the populations we're dealing with are homeless or have other chronic health issues, behavioral health issues, addiction, issues that really compound the problems that we face in connecting people to treatment. And again, that's why we're really looking, we're expanding our partnerships at the community level. We are working to ensure that community health centers and community providers have the resources to be able to identify and connect with those populations to get them PrEP. And one of the biggest things, obviously, is to make that medication available at no cost. Because, again, we're talking about a population that has traditionally very low resources, high rates of uninsured, or people who aren't already enrolled in an insurance program. And all of this is part of creating a really comprehensive approach to identifying and reaching those populations at risk so that we can prevent further spread of HIV.
Does Medicaid cover this?
It does.
Okay. So then there's people outside even the Medicaid category.
Correct. So individuals who do not have any drug coverage, any drug insurance, pharmaceutical insurance, uh-huh. people who are currently testing negative for HIV, and people who have a prescription for PrEP, and that's the name of the name of the medication, are able to access medication for free. And this has been a negotiation and an agreement that has been put together between the Department of Health and Human Services and our Secretary Alex Azar and the manufacturer of the drugs. And they have committed to providing up to 200,000 patients with free PrEP medication for up to 10 years. So we're really excited that we believe that this really just blows away a huge barrier that was standing in the way of connecting some of the at-risk population with PrEP.
So when I was reading this and when I prepared my script, I said the program could benefit more than 1 million people in the U.S. who are at risk for HIV. So how does that more than 200,000 people that the prescription drug or the drug pharmaceutical companies will pay for, how does that get to 1 million?
Well, there are additional people who are at risk who have health insurance and have coverage.
Okay.
There are people who are at risk who are not currently utilizing PrEP to protect them from infection. And there are a lot of those people are insured. And also a big part of, in addition to obviously the donation of PrEP is really targeted towards that uninsured population and some of that high needs population. But we're engaged with partners all around the country in working to raise awareness among the population at risk. Another area that is really important to us is the undiagnosed population, because we have anywhere from 10 to 15% of the HIV positive population in the country hasn't actually been diagnosed. So they're not even aware that they're HIV positive. So it is a multifaceted campaign, and what it really is allowing us to do is to focus strategic public health outreach with the new science, with the scientific and medical breakthroughs that have happened over the last three generations. And what we've seen over the last several years, you know, obviously new HIV/AIDS cases peaked about 15 years ago, and since then it has come down, but it's plateaued. It's not continuing to go down. And what we're determined to do, what the president has charged us with doing, is making that bold next step where we're going to get from this plateaued level of new HIV cases every year, and we're going to drive that down towards zero.
What does geography have to do with this? People who are in more remote areas, there's not only just the accessibility itself, but transportation to get to the medication. Can it be mailed? And also there's a lot more stigma, is there not?
Sure. And yes, under this PrEP program, individuals can get the medication by mail, just like most medications today.
Okay.
One of the great things about this is we've also got partnership with CVS, Rite Aid, and Walgreens, who are donating their fill services, the services of actually filling the prescriptions and providing support to patients at the pharmacy level. So that enhances the positive impact as well. But you raise a really good point, because one of the strategies behind this is we've really wanted to try to attack this problem based upon our surveillance and our data. Understand where the problem is and where we allocate resources. So we've done this, again, there's a multifaceted approach. We're targeting 52 metropolitan areas in the country that account for over half of new HIV cases every year. So we're going to where the problem is concentrated. And three of those metro areas are in Ohio, and that's Cuyahoga, Franklin, and Hamilton counties. And we've already been working very closely with the public health departments there in those counties, as well as with Dr. Amy Acton, State Public Health Commissioner there in Columbus, working on collaborating and coordinating the plans in those jurisdictions. In addition, along the lines of what you mentioned, we're also putting together strategies to cover rural areas. We've targeted some states that have particularly high incidences of rural HIV infection mm-hmm. to really be able to attack specifically the problem in rural areas so we can understand what are going to be the best ways that we can enhance and broaden those approaches around the country. It's worth noting, it's not an issue in Ohio, but we've also got a specific strategy for dealing with HIV infections in tribal communities, which raises a whole nother number of social and cultural issues that we're dealing with. And all of this has an overlay of reducing stigma, making treatment, making support services, making medications as available broadly as possible, and really leveraging those community relationships to help further break down stigma.
To what extent is the opioid epidemic, which is a huge issue in Ohio, as you well know, how is that a factor here? How does that, what kind of challenges does that pose in this campaign?
What it does now, statistically, you know, obviously HIV can be transmitted through intravenous drug use. The data still shows that that's a pretty small subset of new cases. Mm. But what's critically important and what the infectious disease experts have factored into our plan is that there can be outbreaks most likely based upon intravenous drug use. Mm-hmm. We saw that in Scott County, Indiana, a few years ago, where right. there was an HIV outbreak that was directly tied to intravenous drug use. So while the numbers remain small, the potential risk remains relatively high. And that's also factored into our approach across the country, both in rural and metro areas, that we have to have robust surveillance. We have to have very, very effective response. If we see an outbreak or if we see an HIV cluster, it generally can be tracked to intravenous drug use and then attacked at that level. And one of the other things, we're also very, very strongly supporting syringe exchange services around the country. That is something that is pretty new. But Secretary Azar, Dr. Jerome Adams, our Surgeon General, are huge advocates of the usefulness of syringe exchange services. And I visited one in Hamilton County just a couple of months ago, mm-hmm. and it's really doing remarkable work and having a tremendous positive impact, not only on HIV, but also on hepatitis.
Right. And there's a lot of evidence that comes out of Western Europe on that account, is there not?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're seeing, there are, I believe, 12 syringe exchange services in Ohio. Most of them are in those three counties. So, mm-hmm. you know, again, getting those services targeted to where the need is greatest. And, we're obviously working with our state and local public health partners to help stand up more and more of those programs, because we strongly believe in their effectiveness.
I'm going to turn to Chris now in Columbus. You're on the air with Douglas O'Brien. He's the regional director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Hi, Chris.
Wow, this is mind-boggling. I mean, just to give you some perspective, I'm a seasoned ICU nurse of 30 years. Mm-hmm. I'm now a director of Pop Health, and I was at the epicenter working Doctors North, Short North area, when this all broke out about 25, 30 years ago. And for those who are younger, I just want to tell you the sense of dark and doom we felt in the healthcare field as this approached. Not only was this a sure sign of death, it was a horrible death. I mean, my patients were basically drowning in their own lungs. So just really fantastic. So two questions. Number one, just practically, about how much is this costing per treatment for the taxpayers and citizens? I think it's fantastic. But just, you know, kind of what's that perspective? And number two, does this have other implications for other diseases in the near future, maybe cancer or other autoimmune diseases? Mm. Thanks again for this wonderful show.
Thank you, Chris. Yes, Chris recalls the dark days. I remember them well myself. I go back like 35 years and knew people. But Douglas O'Brien, what about the cost and the other implications for other diseases?
Yeah, thanks. And Chris, I just want to say thank you for the work you do, because your work is absolutely critical to the success of any program like this. And we do remember, it really is amazing. And to me personally, to be involved in an initiative like this is really something that is, it is actually an honor to be part of this, because I think it's going to be one of the most meaningful public health efforts that we've undertaken here in this country in a generation. But as I said, on this PrEP program, and Ready, Set, PrEP is the name of the program. This is really essentially at no cost to the taxpayers, with the exception of the sort of administrative and structural work that we're doing.
And the outreach, right?
Right. But actually, it's interesting, because the pharmacies that are donating their services, it's not just filling the, you know, filling the prescriptions, but providing the kind of support services that pharmacies do for medication utilization for patients. So there's going to be access to help from pharmacies on how to take the medication, how to stay on the medication, and of course the donation of the medication itself, which is huge, because it is thousands of dollars per month at a sort of retail level. And so this makes a huge difference in access for populations for whom, you know, who are not covered, and for whom obviously paying for this medication would be impossible.
What about people who are only modestly covered when it comes to prescription insurance, prescription coverage, that it's still expensive? What about them?
Well, there are a number of programs around the country, both state and local, that can help with things like copays. Mm-hmm. And in addition to manufacturer programs, Gilead does have a program to help for copays for certain qualifying patients. But there are also additional programs, a wide variety of them that could be philanthropic, or they could be state or local programs. There are a lot of copay programs also funded through the Ryan White program, which is a federal program that provides significant funding in Ohio every year for HIV and AIDS services. So one of the key things here, too, in addition, is that one of the things that we're really keying in on here is that this availability of PrEP, and knowing that it's available, people in underserved populations who are not connected with healthcare, we're hoping that this is going to be a great incentive for them to go to their FQHC, their federally qualified health center, or to a community health center, and to be able to walk in and say, all right, I want to get PrEP. I need PrEP. I'm at risk. But it's also going to provide them with connection to primary care, to a medical home, and it's going to have a positive impact on the totality of their care. So, you know, there are a lot of ancillary benefits to this, and also specifically since we're talking about populations that have some significant health needs as it is, we're looking forward to seeing some really positive impacts across the board.
Douglas O'Brien, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
And one thing I do just want to mention, mm-hmm. for folks who are interested, there's a website you can go to see if you qualify and to get signed up for Ready, Set, PrEP, and that's getyourprep.com, or by calling 855-447-8410, and you can talk to a counselor there, and they can get your information and find out if you're eligible for Ready, Set, PrEP to be able to get connected with the medication you need.
We will post that website and also that phone number on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Again, Douglas O'Brien, he's Regional Director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks for your time. Thanks to the call from Chris, ICU nurse going on 30 years, remembers the dark days of AIDS and HIV, as do many of us. Things have changed. This is All Sides.
Indeed they have.
This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at wosu.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 1960, a British immunologist received the Nobel Prize for his discovery of the role of acquired immune tolerance in organ transplant failures. Soon after, anti-rejection drugs were developed to enable patients to receive organs from non-identical donors. That was a major turning point in the history of organ transplants. And medicine turned another corner on Sunday when the heart of an Ohio man became the first in U.S. history to be donated after circulatory death. Andrew Mullins is the COO of Lifeline of Ohio, which facilitated the donations in this case. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
There were two milestones achieved in this case. Tell us about the donor. Who was he, and why did it matter?
Yes, the donor. It's all about the donor. Yeah. And the transplant doesn't happen without the donor. And the donor was 26-year-old Justice Yoder from Bell Fountain. And he was able to give the gift of life to five different individuals from six organs being able to be recovered and transplanted from this donation after circulatory death donor.
He was the first adult in the U.S. to donate his heart after circulatory death.
Correct.
So we usually think of organ donation after brain death.
Correct.
What's the difference? What's the significance here?
Correct. So the brain death is the complete and irreversible cessation of all function of the brain, including the brainstem, about 1% of all deaths in the United States. And so what donation after circulatory death is the individual has some sort of irreversible brain injury, some sort of traumatic injury, and the family has made the decision to take them off the ventilator. And at that point in time, once the ventilator has been removed, death is pronounced by the physician caring for that patient. And at that point, there's a five-minute waiting period. And then following that, the incision's made by the surgical recovery team and the organs can be recovered for transplant. So it's providing a lot more opportunity for patients to become organ donors.
Because there are a lot more circulatory deaths.
Correct.
Than there are brain deaths.
Correct. A lot more.
There's a device that we're talking about. So when we're talking about circulatory death, the thing here is that they were not only able to transplant four other organs, but also the heart.
Correct.
That was a really big deal. Why?
Correct. So historically, from donation after circulatory death donors, kidneys, liver, and then more recently, lungs have been able to be recovered for transplant. This is the first adult heart, as you mentioned, in the United States being able to be recovered for transplantation. And it's really about the opportunity for, with new machine preservation technology that's able to take an organ such as the heart that's obviously pumping the blood throughout our body. And once it has stopped, it now has this warm ischemic time without oxygen that's occurring and blood pumping throughout the body. And so it can then be recovered, placed on this machine that then can create that viability for the heart for transplantation that did not exist historically.
They're calling it the heart in a box?
Correct. I think that's just like a general term that we like to refer to.
Which
it
is easy to visualize, sure. But is that a really accurate description? I mean, how big is the box? Is it as big as a bread box?
I would say it's about the size of a larger cooler, per se. And it's on wheels that you can roll the machine because it's, I'm sure, fairly heavy. And so it just makes it, it's able to be portable, though. It can fly and things like that. In this case, it was able to fly to Duke University.
Right. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a big turning point in the history of organ transplant. The heart of an Ohio man on Sunday became the first in U.S. history to be donated after circulatory death. My guest is Andrew Mullins. He's the COO of Lifeline of Ohio, which facilitated the donation. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, when we talk about circulatory death, in this case, he had a heart attack.
Yes, in this case, he suffered a heart attack, I believe it was on November the 25th, that then actually took him to Mary Ratan Hospital in Bell Fountain and then transferred to Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center.
And he was part of a study?
So this is a the donation after circulatory death for hearts to be recovered for transplant is part of a clinical trial. I believe it goes to the end of 2021, and the goal is to have 212 organ hearts recovered and transplanted. And so I believe there's five centers throughout the United States that are involved in this, and Duke was the first to obviously transplant.
Did the fact that the donor was very young make this a better possibility, a better candidate?
I believe it depends. There's older patients that are probably healthier than younger patients nowadays. So there's age criteria that's in place, I believe, for the clinical study that goes up to 49 years of age, I believe,
for
donation after mm-hmm. circulatory death. We always say there is no age for people to sign up to be an organ donor, for organ donation to take place. I believe there's even a liver that was recovered and transplanted from a 90-some-year-old. But in this particular scenario, I believe the cutoff age for the trial is 49 years of age.
He was very young. He was in his 20s.
He was 26 years of age, yes.
Right. Do we know more about what took him? I mean, we know it was a heart attack, but why?
Yes, I just know that he suffered a cardiac arrest that brought him into the hospital. So that's what I know.
How the device expands the pool of donors, how much so? I mean, you said it was 1% before?
So 1% of patients die from brain death.
Okay.
I would say from this scenario, there's a potential for a 30% increase in the number of hearts to be recovered and transplanted from DCD.
And more in other organs?
So we're seeing, kidneys from donation after circulatory death donation. We're seeing kidneys are pretty much recovered from most of our DCD donors, as well as the liver. Sometimes the lungs. The lungs can be rare.
And they're transported or they're maintained before the transplant in the ordinary way or the traditional way.
Correct.
They don't need the special box that the heart does.
Correct. However, I would say that most of the organs are packaged and placed on ice,
uh-huh.
Which is pretty much the historical way. I would say that many organs now are seeing more machine preservation technology, such as the kidneys. For decades, there's been a pulsatile perfusion machine for the kidneys to increase their viability as well for transplant. And so that happens fairly routine, as well as other organs such as the liver and lungs.
And if it's a circulatory death, there's a cardiac arrest involved. Mm-hmm. Isn't there damage to the heart then? How can it be as good of a candidate? Or is that the point, is it's not always as good of a candidate?
I think the point is that the heart has suffered, has ultimately stopped, right? And the patient has been declared cardiac dead. And
uh-huh.
and based off of a fairly quick recovery right after from when the surgeons can do the recovery, it's a very fast procedure at that point. And then the organ's placed on that machine, which also has blood from the donor that's placed into that machine that also goes back into that heart. So I believe the combination of a short period of warm ischemic time without that organ having oxygen, plus the organ being placed on the machine, has to lead to the success of the transplant.
And if there's damage to the heart during the process of dying, can it be fixed?
So I would say that what happens in this is the surgeons, the transplant surgeons who are doing the recovery, are going to make that assessment based off of their own clinical judgment at the time, whether or not they would feel that the heart would be suitable or not suitable for transplant based off of what they know.
So this ended up being a transplant that occurred, at least the heart transplant occurred at Duke University
Correct.
Medical Center. How does it work now? I mean, a lot of us take for granted that Lifeline Ohio is out there and that there are organizations all over the country like yours
Sure.
doing this, facilitating the transport of the organs for transplant. But how does it work? What's the process these days?
So what happens is we partner with 78 hospitals throughout our service area in 37 counties in Ohio and 2 counties in West Virginia. And when there's a death that has occurred or a death that's imminent, we receive a call from the hospital. And at that point in time, we send one of our team members over to do an evaluation to see if donation's even potential. We then have the opportunity, in this case, once the family has made the decision to withdraw support, we have the conversation with the family about the donation. In this case, Justice was a registered organ donor. He had already made the decision, and his family had actually brought up donation as well, knowing their son's wishes.
And what has been, organ donation, again, is pretty common. People I think attitudes have changed a great deal regarding it, but it's still kind of shocking how little or how few people can be helped by it.
So 60% of Ohioans are currently registered as organ and tissue donors.
That's
which
a lot
is great.
Compared to even 10 years
is.
Ago,
it's,
isn't it?
It's great. Yes, it continues to arise, and I would say it's based off of the generosity of Ohioans and others that they've made the decision, and they're talking with their families and telling them about it. And so I would say that, you know, that's the first thing, make the decision, and then the opportunity for donation. And with technology and various things, once someone has said yes to donation after they die and we're able to facilitate organ donation, great things are happening with more and more patients are being able to be transplanted, which is the key. It all ends up being more lives saved. That's what this is about.
Is there a constantly fluid list of who's waiting for what?
Yes, the list changes all the time. You hear the national list and you'll hear patients say they're number one on the list. There's really no way to know where you stand on the list because it's ever evolving depending on multiple factors, including distance and size and weight of the patient, blood type, severity of illness, things like that, that play into that ever-changing list. But that's how we allocate the organs.
They've been curing a lot of people of hepatitis C now.
Correct.
There's new medication out there. Does that change their prospects to be organ donors in the future?
So we've transplanted hepatitis B into Hep B, Hep C into Hep C, HIV now through the HOPE Act. So there are very few potential rule outs for someone to be an organ donor. We'd always encourage everyone to sign up, and then we evaluate the time of an individual's death, whether or not the potential for donation exists.
Andrew Mullins, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having us.
That's Andrew Mullins. He is COO of Lifeline of Ohio, which helped facilitate the organ transplantation of a man who died last week on Sunday. They were able to get his heart and other organs out to other people who needed them. And it was the first time in U.S. history that someone in the United States was donated after circulatory death. We'll have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. About 3.4 million U.S. residents have epilepsy. Now a new study has found that three drugs used to treat severe seizures in epilepsy patients are equally effective. We're talking about why this matters today. Dr. William Bell is the director of the Division of Epilepsy at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
They're equally effective drugs. Why is this important? Why does it matter?
Well, this was a study that was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine that's looking at status epilepticus. Status epilepticus is when seizures become repetitive such that patients are seriously ill. And so it wasn't really known which was the best drug because there's many drugs that are used. And so this was three different drugs.
So there are three different ways to treat it.
Correct. Three different medications.
Okay. Three different. Do they all do basically the same thing?
They have different mechanisms, but the end result is apparently from this study, they resulted in successful treatment.
Is that good news or does it really matter to the rest of us? Or is it a curiosity and interesting, but otherwise irrelevant? I don't know.
It's not irrelevant. I mean, most people don't get the status epilepticus, but for those that do, it's good to know that we have something that's going to be beneficial for them.
Because the different medications have different side effects.
They do. Although when you're in status epilepticus, it's assumed that you're going to have some side effects from the medication because the repetitive seizures are dangerous in themselves.
Dangerous to your brain.
Correct.
How so? What is a seizure? What's happening with a seizure that's associated with epilepsy?
Well, a seizure is an uncontrolled discharge or numerous discharges. I like to use an analogy say you had all the lights, traffic lights in Columbus to suddenly turn green, and all the cars would do, speed up to 120 miles per hour, you would have chaos. And I think this chaos is what happens when you have a seizure. Now, the chaos may be in a small part of the brain, and so people may even be aware that they're having a seizure, but often it takes over the entire brain temporarily so that they are unconscious when they're having the seizure.
And the medications, what were they formulated to do?
For this study, they were given IV and they're formulated to stop the status epilepticus in its tracks.
How do they do that?
They give it intravenously, mm-hmm. and they give it in such a dose that it's known to put the brain to sleep, or put it or really dampen down the excitatory discharges.
It's quieting.
Correct.
The chaos.
Yes.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about epilepsy today and the news that three drugs used to treat severe seizures in epilepsy patients are pretty much equally effective. My guest is Dr. William Bell. He's a neurologist in Columbus. He's director of the Division of Epilepsy at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. If you have a question about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Are these drugs that, these three drugs that we're talking about, or these drug combinations, these treatments, are they intended to be given to somebody who is in a seizure? Or are they something that you take to prevent seizures?
They're actually these particular formulations are meant to be given to patients in a seizure. Although there are some related medications, these drugs are also formulated in tablet form, so they're given to patients for epilepsy who have chronic seizures.
Right, because my dog has epilepsy, and I recognized Keppra. And we give our dog, you know, I think some formulation of Keppra or something like that to arrest them before they start.
Dogs frequently have epilepsy. It's fairly common. Certain drugs can be used in dogs. Keppra is one of them, but their metabolism is enough that not all human drugs are used in dogs.
Does it? You said the dogs have them. I learned this from our own experience that it's quite common. Has that been a way to study epilepsy?
Yes, they are. Canine epilepsy is studied as a model for epilepsy.
Why is it so common in canines? I mean, have we learned anything about that, and how? And does that inform us as far as humans are concerned?
I don't really know
about canine epilepsy. What accounts for differences in outcomes for patients when it comes to the medication? Do we know?
We don't really know. We know there's some people that have definite brain injuries that in that case they have extremely difficult time controlling their seizures. But the usual seizures and the epilepsy that occurs throughout the lifetime that occurs spontaneously in basically normal people, we find that 2/3 of the time they can be controlled with medication. 1/3 of the time they cannot be. And that's when we start to look at other treatments such as epilepsy surgery and devices.
Do people get epilepsy for different reasons?
Correct, they do. We know, for example, that older adults may get epilepsy due to strokes or injuries, but idiopathic, or which is a fancy term for we don't really know, is the most common cause at almost any age. So many times it's frustrating to patients that we do make the diagnosis and they want to know, well, what caused this? And we're not able to tell them.
Is there a sense, or do we know if people live with epilepsy undiagnosed until it gets worse and worse and worse?
Some people do. For example, we may have patients that have very minor, small seizures that are attributed to just daydreaming or falling asleep, and then they have a big seizure, and then we realize that those other events were smaller seizures.
What happens in the brain? We established earlier that it can damage the brain, or does damage the brain. How so? What happens to the brain?
So it's typically only severe seizures that go on a long period of time that damage the brain. It's really unclear if individual small seizures greatly damage the brain. It's really unclear and probably does not. But there are some glutamate is an excitotoxin that gets activated with seizures. It's a normal neurotransmitter, but in great quantities, it can cause what we call a cytotoxic injury. So it's thought that that kind of mechanism, if the neurotransmitters are upregulated and are high in the system, that there can be some damage.
Does it matter about the age of the person? In other words, if a baby is having severe seizures, is it in a developing brain? Does that make a difference?
Well, babies will have seizures that are different because their brains are different, and it depends on the age of the child, the baby, that they can have in their development. It can be catastrophic, or sometimes it's something that'll go away. And many times, children will have seizures that do actually go away.
Let's see. Shirley in New Albany, you're on the air with Dr. William Bell of the Wexner Center. Hi, Shirley.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, my dog Hank is an epileptic, and he is on 3 zonisamide or zonisamide. I'm not sure of the pronunciation. And 1.5 of prednisone twice a day. And I was wondering, is this a... also a treatment for humans?
Dr. Wilt Bell?
So this zonisamide is a common anti-epileptic, anti-seizure medication. As far as steroids, we do use that in certain cases, but it's not routine. We don't routinely use prednisone or steroids.
Why would you use it anyway?
The prednisone or steroids would be used as an anti-inflammatory, and it is known that there is an inflammatory process that may be going on with seizures. And there's great interest in looking at that in humans, but we don't routinely prescribe prednisone for epilepsy in humans.
When I was reading about the rates of disease, I read that close to 80% of people with epilepsy live in low and middle income countries. Do we understand why there's a higher prevalence of it in low and middle income countries?
I don't really know. I do know that in many countries, such as Latin America, there are some known causes of epilepsy with parasites. And in Texas, where I'm from, where I actually practiced, it's one of the most common causes is neurocysticercosis.
What's that?
It's a tapeworm, pork tapeworm, that is common in cultures that do not fully cook pork because it's considered a delicacy.
Uh-huh.
And that's a very common cause of epilepsy. I don't know, I cannot give you I don't have knowledge of the other countries, yes, it's common the world over. It's really extremely common.
Do we know, can it be congenital? Can you be born with it?
Yes, so there are some genetic causes. Some are born with it because of injury they receive around the time of their birth. Others, it's genetic, and genetic epilepsies start at various times in childhood.
If it's genetic, does that necessarily mean that it's a more severe kind of epilepsy or not?
It's variable. Many of the genetic ones actually are fairly easy to control with medication, and some will go away, but some remain severe.
Is there a way to tell if an infant is having a seizure?
Yes, we do a test called an electroencephalogram, or EEG.
Yeah.
And that can be done in adults or children or neonates. And it's pretty accurate in being able to determine if there's a seizure ongoing.
Can you tell if you've had a seizure in the past with that?
There are markers of epilepsy with an EEG. So when we do routine EEGs, we're not necessarily expecting someone to have a seizure during that study, but they may be revealed interictal epileptiform discharges that will be a marker that they've had seizures in the past and may have seizures in the future.
I know a severe head injury can be one of the causes of epilepsy. So when we're talking about a severe head injury, could that also include repetitive injuries that build up over time?
Yes, it could.
Like concussions, I guess is what I'm trying to get at, yeah.
Certainly, a single concussion is seldom a cause of seizures, but it is possible with a series of concussions, and particularly if there's any kind of injury where they do a CT scan and find that there's blood from that injury, even if it's modest, that could certainly set up a seizure focus.
When we were talking about the three medications that have been shown to have the same, you know, that they're equally effective. And you said that they were in the study were given the drugs intravenously during seizures.
Yes.
Is there a way to get the drugs to people when they're having a seizure without having to go into a hospital or an emergency room or something like that?
Correct. So we do have some medications. One is diazepam or Valium, as it's better known, and the rectal version is called Diastat. And we've been giving that for years for patients that have severe seizures. We have a new drug that's just been released called Nayzilam, and it's midazolam given intranasally.
Okay.
And that drug has been compounded from the intravenous drug in this area for several years, but it's now been released as an official FDA-approved medication. It can be given intranasally. It can get in the system very quickly.
Okay. I was going to say the advantage of that is that it goes through the mucous membranes, that kind of a thing?
Yes.
And then as far as the incidence of epilepsy in, as you mentioned, South America because of parasites, is there any concern in the community that studies epilepsy that with climate change and as things shift north and things become warmer, that these parasites could start to affect people farther north?
I guess it could. I mean, some of this is not necessarily the climate, but the cultural habits of the
right.
people.
Right. As you mentioned, not cooking pork thoroughly and that
Correct.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
So I don't know if I can make that leap, but I guess it's theoretically possible.
What else is around the corner? I mean, is this a good time? That's such a trite way to put it, but a good time. I mean, are things a lot better now for people who have epilepsy?
I think there's a lot more options for treatment. Just recently in the last few years, we brought over from Europe a technique that we've just started to do at Ohio State with robotic stereo EEG electrode implantation. Okay. And it's a safe way to get electrodes in someone's head so that we can try to pinpoint the seizure focus.
I think I talked to the surgeon one time who was developing that at Ohio State. How does it work? How do you do that?
So you did some very detailed imaging studies, and you try to mesh that with a computer model, and then the surgeon's able to take the electrodes and precisely place that electrode in a target in the brain.
What are you seeing when you do that?
So you actually can demonstrate the electrode trajectory with some of the images, and you know precisely the distance that you need to go. And then we're in the operating room, and we're actually watching the electrodes and see what kind of signal that we get. And we're looking at all these aspects, looking at the imaging, avoiding blood vessels. So it's quite an interesting thing. So it takes a few hours to do this, but it makes the process much safer.
Is it becoming at all routine?
It's becoming more routine. Up until maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we did it in a more invasive manner, and now we're doing it this way more and more.
So with robots?
More and more centers are using this robotic electrode implantation method.
And that then, does that eliminate the need for medications and drugs?
Well, the purpose is to pinpoint and find a seizure focus.
Okay.
And so if we can find a seizure focus in an area of the brain that can be safely removed without causing impairment, then that surgery occurs. But now we have a lot more options to treat that focus. We have devices that can be implanted close to that focus. We can resect it. We can. We have deep brain stimulation. So we have even laser-guided ablation of areas of the brain.
Dr. William Bell, thanks so much for joining us and talking about this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. William Bell, he is a neurologist in Columbus. He's director of the Division of Epilepsy at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.